Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Spencer Davis, professor of history at Peru State College. Dr. Davis will present the fourth and final talk in his four-lecture series on the topic, The American Civil War, a look back 150 years ago. Today's topic will be, Where Do We Go From Here? October to December 1862. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Saturday afternoon, December 8, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Museum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Mick Hale, Director of Education at the Durham Museum.
Our presenter tonight, Dr. Spencer Davis, is a professor of history at Peru State College, and has presented several programs related to this time period here at the museum. We greatly appreciate his support with our programming and with the museum's mission. We're very excited to have him on board for this series of presentations. So with that, I give it over to Dr. Spencer Davis.
Thanks, Mick. Well, I'm very glad to be here and be able to speak on this topic. I'm Spencer Davis. I've had a wonderful time giving quarterly programs about the Civil War in 1862. I'm very appreciative to the staff of the Durham Museum for the help they've given me and the opportunity, and also to thank the Nebraska Committee on the Humanities, which has also been a sponsor as well. Before I get into the last 3 months of 1862, I want to do a little whirlwind tour of the year 1862, a kind of overview. The first thing that occurred to me is to notice some things that maybe we lose track of when we go through this specific narrative. One would be, this is the year that Lee proved to be a great general. Earlier, he hadn't done so well, but in 1862, he proved to be incredibly daring and a great general. 1862 is also the year that Lincoln proved to be a great president. He was untried as an executive, and he met the political crises of 1862 and showed that he had not only the potential, but was in fact a great president. 1862 is the year the meaning and purpose and scope of the war changed. The Emancipation Proclamation changed the war from a war for union to a war for union and emancipation, and made it consequential then for the transformation of America years after the fighting would be over. So the nature of the war changed in 1862. The war also changed because it became much harsher. Shiloh and then Antietam were battles with thousands of casualties. And we'll come to one, the very end of 1862, Murfreesboro, where each side had a casualty rate of about 33%. And so the war took on the battlefield, a new harshness. There were also other signs of a harsher mood and a more violent war. There were episodes when soldiers tried to surrender and were shot, where at least a couple of occasions where prisoners were executed. More and more, the armies lived off the countryside without paying civilians. The war became one of economic war. The blockade of the Union began to take effect and dug into the life of civilians in the Confederacy. So the war changed greatly in 1862. It also changed psychologically a couple of times. Early in 1862, with the early victories, people in the North thought victory might be very close. Fort Henry fell, Fort Donelson was taken, New Orleans was taken, and there was a great enthusiasm in the northern states. And then this success seemed to evaporate. There was confusion. McClellan did not succeed. Lee defeated him. And the Union momentum vanished. And in fact, in the fall, the Confederacy planned to return to both Maryland and Kentucky. Lee would lead his army into Maryland, and Braxton Bragg would lead his army into Tennessee and then into Kentucky. And they had high hopes of victory to take back two of the border states and to change the momentum of the war. And this momentum was frustrated by Union victories. And so by the end of the war, people both North and South could wonder what the result would be, when they might regain momentum, how long the war would last, what its costs would be. So 1862 is a very consequential year, even perhaps a pivotal war. The meaning of the war changed, the nature of the war changed. The great scholar Alan Nevins pointed this out, and I have his book over here. Though it's more than 50 years old, I think it's an engagingly written and powerful narrative of how 1862 was the year the war went from war to revolution. And I recommend it very highly, and all the points I've made I've taken from Nevins' great work. Well, with that as a look, here we're going to sort of target in on the great change of the Emancipation Proclamation. It was advocated by abolitionists like Douglass eloquently, sometimes even intemperately, unable to see how a war against slaveholders wouldn't be also a war against the institution of slavery. Douglass thought that was inevitable, and every moment wasted before declaring emancipation, he thought, wasted. Here was a senator, a Republican, who was a radical and who similarly thought emancipation should be a war aim. He thought very highly of himself. He was a difficult person, but he was a brilliant and hard-working Republican radical. And here is the great roadblock. Justice Taney, who'd written the Dred Scott decision, and it was thought might very well lead another Supreme Court majority and reject any emancipation. And calculating how emancipation might be done and pass the Supreme Court tests was one of the things that weighed on Lincoln. Here's the great editor, inconstant, fluctuating, up and down, hard to figure, but eloquent editor Horace Greeley, whose letter gave Lincoln an opportunity to alert the public that if emancipation would help with victory, it was a strategy he would adopt. And here's Lincoln's letter. Lincoln makes clear at the end a distinction that he maintained always, and that was his own moral feeling was distinct from the powers he had under the Constitution. Before he could issue the Emancipation Proclamation, he wanted a victory. His cabinet had suggested that as well. Antietam was a very costly battle, and it wasn't much of a victory, but Lee withdrew from Maryland, and that was enough for Lincoln. And so victory at Antietam, delivered by McClellan, he should have won because, after all, he had a copy of Lee's battle plan. And with that, it would be hard to lose. Nevertheless, he was slow enough to make it into a close-run thing and just a modest victory. But it was enough, and Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation preliminary version in September. Lincoln had worked on it for several months. He'd waited for the military victory. And he knew, of course, that Confederate states would not leave the Confederacy and return to the Union and avoid its consequences. So he knew that come January the 1st, 1863, he would issue the final Emancipation Proclamation and it would become a war aim of the Union. And as long as the Republicans remained in control and he was reelected in 1864, it would be a war aim of the Union. It did less immediately, but it was a promise of what the end of the war had to be like. And so that brings us then to the final 3 months of this eventful, consequential year. I'm going to start with a political episode. It's the most famous, and it's told wonderfully by Doris Kearns Goodwin and by many other historians. It's the cabinet crisis. Secretary of the Treasury Chase had a very high opinion of himself. One of his detractors said he thought he was the fourth person of the Trinity, which was bad theology and bad arithmetic, but psychologically perhaps perceptive. He bridled at the thought that Lincoln was president when he considered himself much better prepared. And he plotted incessantly, and he planted among Republican senators the feeling that another member of the cabinet, Seward, was dragging his feet and holding back the Union effort, and the war wouldn't be won unless Seward was pushed out of the cabinet. And then came the Battle of Fredericksburg, another one of these agonizing losses. Lincoln had tried a new general, this time Burnside. He also was defeated by Lee. So in the aftermath of another serious defeat, and with Chase's rumors doing their bit, Republicans in the Senate decided to vote that Seward be removed from the cabinet and to take this decision to Lincoln. And Lincoln met with them and told them to return the next evening and he would have a more final determination. And the next evening when he returned, he had all of the cabinet except Seward there. And he asked each of them if it weren't true that cabinet meetings had been generally amicable and that they had usually agreed, and everyone had been able to speak his piece. And this cornered Chase. If he agreed, then the tales he'd been planting on the senators would seem false. And if he disagreed, he would be disagreeing with the other cabinet members and his president. And so he was caught, and so he did double talk and shuffling. But in the end, he said, yes, we did. We did meet. We did talk. And so the air went out of this movement. The senators were exasperated and infuriated with Chase, and Lincoln had shown a very skillful management of this crisis. Sometimes it's pictured as just a kind of victory for logic. Lincoln understood how to box in Chase in a logical dilemma, and being illogical was sufficient to destroy his influence on the radicals. But it seems to me that there is more than that to what happened. This was a kind of elemental conflict of will as well as logic. And face-to-face in a small room, Lincoln bested Chase. And of course, it's good to have logic on your side. That's a great weapon. But I think there was also a matter of a strength, a determination, a solidity that Lincoln had and Chase lacked. And this demonstrated beyond the way that Chase exaggerated, it showed that Lincoln would not be bullied. He would not be reduced as president. He would not be outmaneuvered, and that he was truly the chief executive. It's a great set piece of political history and leadership studies, and well worth the retelling. Well, then we move on to the battlefield then of what happened in these 3 months. Corinth wasn't much of a battle. The Confederates attacked. They found out that Rosecrans had a great many more soldiers than they did and much better supplies. And so they retreated, and Corinth remained in Union hands. It was a small town, overgrown village, maybe you'd call it, in Mississippi, but it was a great railroad center. And it was key if Union forces were going to be able to go after Vicksburg. And so holding Corinth was a sizable Union advantage. The next battle was Perryville. This was part of that attempt of the Confederates to go through Tennessee and to take power in Kentucky. The Union forces were led by the not very energetic Don Carlos Buell, and Confederate forces were led by Braxton Bragg, a personal favorite of Jefferson Davis, but an argumentative and sometimes a bullheaded Confederate leader. And they got into Kentucky. They even occupied the capital for a little while and inaugurated a Confederate governor, but then they had to vamoose because Union forces were coming. Eventually, they fought at Perryville. And again, the battlefield was something of a draw, but the Confederates, outnumbered and with dwindling supplies, had to retreat. and they left Kentucky, and so it remained in the Union, and this initiative had failed. Buell was sacked by Lincoln for his lethargy and lack of fighting spirit. There were many who wanted Bragg removed, but his friendship with Jefferson Davis saved him. I use this as an example of how the war in 1862 became harsher. McNeil is not a famous general. In fact, in the books he shows up in, he gets the title infamous. He was in command in Missouri, where there was a nasty guerrilla war going on, went on throughout the war. And in retaliation for a Union supporter being kidnapped and very probably murdered, McNeil hauled from jail 10 Confederate supporters who were in jail and executed them. A simple act of vengeance and an indication of how standards of justice and decency were breaking down. He wouldn't be the only figure, but being a commander, it's particularly egregious, and it's an indication of how the war had become bloodier. Here's another of the figures involved in that Missouri fighting, and notorious. I have to say, Quantrill doesn't look like a raider and a bloody-minded fellow there. But in fact, he, whatever his picture looks like, he was as well. Moving to the next month, November, Lincoln had tired of McClellan's slowness, and he'd visited him after Antietam, urging him on to go after Lee. Lee had retreated after all. Why not go after him? And McClellan had riches of reserves and ammunition and every material for an army. But McClellan resisted Lincoln's entreaties. And then finally, when he did get going, he went at an incredibly slow pace. Lincoln rode him several times. And finally, early in November, lost his patience, relieved McClellan, who didn't command after that, and replaced him with Ambrose Burnside, who'd won some early victories. Burnside felt that he might not be the man for the job, but sort of by elimination, he was the best candidate, and he accepted, and he said to Lincoln, I'll go after Lee. I know what we need to do, which is take the battle to him. And he said, I'll take it to Lee around Fredericksburg. If I can cross there and attack, I will. And Lincoln also wondered if this was the right place, but here was at least a general who appreciated the need to go after Lee quickly. And of course, he gave us the title Sideburns, but he gave Lincoln no victories. He turned out maybe his own inner fear was the best. He had no element of surprise left after the first day or so. Lee was in good position. Lee was outnumbered, but he had strong defensive positions, and Burnside did not show admirable battlefield leadership either, and it was a disheartening loss. The casualties are almost, well, they are more than twice as many for the Union. And another disheartening defeat in the Eastern Theater, a general unable to defeat Robert E. Lee. With the occupying of Corinth and controlling almost all the Mississippi River, Grant turned to taking Vicksburg. And he was leading one force. Sherman had another 30,000 or so, I suppose. But their attempts in 1862 came to nothing. Grant's railroad line was torn up by Confederate raiders. His supply base at Holly Springs, Mississippi, was attacked and completely destroyed. And so he gave up, but communications were so bad, Sherman didn't find out. And so Sherman proceeded, and he attacked Confederate forces within 5 or 10 miles of Vicksburg, and in a horrible, swampy area, and he was defeated as well. And so the end of 1862, Grant was frustrated and would have to find another way to take Vicksburg. This was another depressing result. Vicksburg was in an ideal position, high above the river, and the area around it was much of it impenetrable. Nevertheless, it was the last Confederate stronghold on the Mississippi River, and it was clearly the desired target of the Union forces in the West, and that they couldn't get it after several months of maneuvering was embarrassing and frustrating. Here at the very end of the year, in fact, it carries over into the first days of 1863, is another battle, Murfreesboro. This battle has the highest casualty rate of any battle in the Civil War. Rosecrans is not a famous general, and of course Bragg's shortcomings I've described earlier. Bragg attacked Rosecrans on the first day, retreated. He retreated actually into much better defenses. And when a day or so later Bragg attacked, Union forces were in very strong position, and even with the artillery firing as well as the infantry, the Confederate losses were very high. And at the end, Bragg had to retreat. And Lincoln wrote Rosecrans and thanked him for a victory, finally a Union victory. He put it in an interesting way, which was that had this been another loss, he didn't know if the Union could survive it, indicating clearly that this victory wasn't the turning point of the war, but it was psychologically necessary. And he was grateful to Rosecrans for such a victory as that. The last thing is also one day into the new year. and that is the issuing of the Emancipation Proclamation. There were some nervous Republicans who thought it was doing them damage and that Lincoln ought to retract it. There were officers and enlisted men who grumbled about it in the Union Army, and there was a feeling that maybe their fighting spirit would not survive if the proclamation really were issued. So there was some pressure on Lincoln, but he stood firm. He said this was the thing he did which would, if anything, make him notable in American history. Lincoln signed it after the New Year's party, and he told those who witnessed it that it was true that his hand was shaking, but not from second thoughts or timidity, but simply from the exhaustion of greeting the hundreds of people who came to the White House that evening, and that he believed in it wholeheartedly. I'm going to read you a couple things about it because I believe it is the most consequential of the things that shaped 1862 and the war. This is to a Democratic general, McClernand, who is from Illinois. My dear sir, your letter is received. I never did ask more, nor ever was willing to accept less than for all the states and the people thereof to take and hold their places in the Union under the Constitution. For this alone I have felt authorized to struggle, and I seek neither more nor less now. Still, to use a coarse but an expressive figure, broken eggs cannot be mended. I have issued the Emancipation Proclamation, and I cannot retract it. Having been made, it must stand. And this is Lincoln's feeling, and he stuck with it. I've got a letter here to Lincoln from an abolitionist, a Quaker in Philadelphia, who's describing the scene January 1st, 1863, in Philadelphia, in the black church that he's gone to take part in the celebration. And this catches the kind of revolutionary import of the proclamation. And it's addressed to Mr. President. I have been all day, from early morning until a short time ago, in the crowded churches of the colored people of this city. During 30 years of active anti-slavery life, I have never witnessed such intense, intelligent, and devout thanksgiving. Occasionally they sang and shouted and wept and cried. God knows I cried with them. As one of their speakers was explaining the effect of your act, he was interrupted by a sudden outburst from 400 or 500 voices singing the Year of Jubilee, an old anti-slavery song that commemorates some of our great names, and we sang it stirringly, even in the dark days of mobs and outrage, and now it was so changed as to include your name. It was sung with wonderful effect. Then he goes on about, never was a demonstration so touching. The black people all trust you. They believe that you desire to do them justice. They do not believe that you wish to expatriate them or to enforce upon them any disability, but that perhaps you cannot do all that you would. Another one of them expressed the thought that there must be some design of God in having your name Abraham, that if you were not the father, you were to be the liberator of a people. One of their ministers advised them to thank God that he had raised up an honest man for the White House, whereupon they all broke forth, 500 strong, in that ringing hymn, the Year of Jubilee. It is a great thing, sir, to be the President of the United States. even though thorns are in the seat of power. But it is a greater thing to be enshrined in the religious sense of a people. And that was the letter of Ashley Plumley to Lincoln. And it captures some of the intensity and also the tremendous import, the revolutionary nature of the Emancipation Proclamation and the changed nature of the war. And not being able to do any better than that, I will stop there. Thank you very much. I'm going to have a question and answer session, but we need a little time to get a microphone for you to use. So if you'll wait just a second, Bob will be here with a mic. And if you have a question, he'll get you the microphone as quickly as he can.
If a national opinion poll was taken after Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, what percentage of the people would have been in favor of, would you say?
In the northern states, I think probably a bare majority, and there would have been a considerable number undecided, and then a quarter or so, I think, probably would have been opposed. This is entirely guesswork on my part, but I think something like that. The Democratic Party was against it. Almost every Democrat in the House voted against the 13th Amendment. So there was considerable opposition to emancipation. And there were Republicans, not so many, but still Republicans, who opposed it. I think another element of this is not so much whether they were in favor or not, but their motive. And I think for very many, the motive was that this was an appropriately powerful way to punish the secessionists, rather than it was an altruistic or morally necessary step. For many, it was the effective way to pursue the war and punish those who'd started it. And so when the war was over and that motive weakened or faded, the number who, on a purely ethical basis, supported emancipation would have been reduced. Lincoln had a majority behind him, but it was a complicated feeling behind their approval.
As a Civil War scholar, what would you say to all the people now who are talking about secession? It's been in the news lately.
Yes, it has. Well, I think if you look at what it meant, of course, it would be a terminology I wouldn't recommend using lightly or tactically. It has a long history behind it. It's been mentioned before, but I think it heads down a dangerous path myself. There are other ways to express one's disapproval, I think, that are less consequential, less serious. I don't think anybody actually, well, not. I think few people mean it in its full sense. Looking back at the secessionists of 1860 and 61, some of them must have meant it merely tactically. Some of them believed in it wholeheartedly. None of them knew what was coming. So I would be hesitant to use it. And I'm puzzled by it. as well.
Do you have any issues with the movie Lincoln?
Thank you. You know what? I instructed my wife, if nobody asked a Lincoln question, that she would, because we did go to see the movie. So thank you very much. It was a powerful movie. It went quickly. I enjoyed it as a movie. I didn't think it was 100% accurate about Lincoln, and you can't expect 100%. I thought it was awfully gloomy, like they didn't have enough candles or something in Washington, or they didn't have any gaslight. But beyond small things like that, I think it exaggerated the connection between this peace movement, this hope for a last-minute negotiation, and the 13th Amendment. This Preston Blair peace meeting and Confederate representatives coming to see Lincoln, I don't think Lincoln or many people in the government thought it would come to anything. Because after all, the Confederates weren't going to give up the idea that they were an independent nation. And so so I don't think they were ever tied together so closely.
Was Thaddeus Stevens exaggerated at all, or was that accurate?
Tommy Lee Jones is just too imposing a person, I think, physically. Stevens was frailer and not in good health, and so I felt it wasn't right exactly. Stevens was a very important Republican. He was the leading radical in the House of Representatives, and so he was someone who would be important. And he didn't always agree with Lincoln. He was extremely independent minded and usually more radical than Lincoln. So he's important, but the picture of him made him different than I believe he was. He was a character. His speeches were abusive, personal attacks, as were many politicians' speeches at the time. I thought it wasn't quite the right Thaddeus Stevens.
What can you say about Lincoln's cabinet? I've heard him described, if I remember the term right, like a team of rivals.
Yes. Several of them were in the beginning. Seward wanted to be a kind of prime minister with Lincoln a figurehead, and Lincoln put that down, and Seward came to see that he wasn't the leader Lincoln was, and became a very effective assistant. But for a while he was a rival. Chase was continually a rival. He wanted the 1864 nomination and continued scheming to get it. So he was all the time. Gideon Welles, the Secretary of the Navy, was not a rival and was very competent. Stanton, the Secretary of War, occasionally ignored Lincoln's orders, but on the whole, he was a workaholic and a tremendous aide. And though he might be argumentative, he wasn't a rival to Lincoln, but a very complicated, independent, strange figure. So there were powerful personalities, and a couple of them were real rivals.
I've heard that during this period of time, there was a attempt on Lincoln's life.
Yes, I think there was. He dismissed His hat was shot off. He was out riding close to Washington, and his hat was shot off. And he said, well, it was just some innocent rabbit hunter whose bullet went astray. But Mrs. Lincoln and his friends in Stanton thought it was an attempt on his life. Mrs. Lincoln was very, very seriously hurt in an accident riding in her carriage, which she believed had been deliberately tampered with and had probably been meant to take the president's life. She was riding in it without him and was thrown from it when the wheel came off and was very hurt. And she thought that was another attempt on his life that went amiss. And of course, John Wilkes Booth was planning to assassinate
Lincoln. Do you know how many attempts were taken on Lincoln's life?
Well, I would say that would be three serious attempts. He got many letters threatening him, and his secretaries filed most of them as the work of cranks who were just venting their anger and didn't mean it. But I think there were at least three that did involve serious follow-through attempts on his life. He said it was something that couldn't be protected against. He had a kind of fatalism, and though he often had guard units around him, he didn't always. Well, there was a crowd in Baltimore that was sort of out of control. The specific note he got, intelligence, I think probably was a rumor. Now, the Secretary of the Army, Winfield Scott, took it seriously and had guards everywhere during the inauguration. And when Lincoln heard from Seward's son, and that was a second sort of notice that something was going to be attempted in Baltimore, he took it seriously, you know, and moved up his train schedule and entered secretly. He apparently wasn't wearing kilts or tam or any disguise. But he did go early and alone and get to Washington early. But I think that was just a rumor of the time.
In Fredericksburg, if Burnside had not waited all those days to get his pontoons to go across the river, do you think he would have had more success?
Oh, yeah, because remember, Lee had split up his forces, and if he'd attacked quickly, Lee would have had even fewer. And brilliant as Lee was, when it came to just raw firepower, being greatly outnumbered, I think, the Union could have defeated him. Would Burnside have followed it up? Probably not. There hadn't been a general in the East yet that did follow up. And it was hard after a battle where there was so much confusion. So I think Lee could have been defeated on the battlefield if Burnside had moved very quickly. But then I don't think his army would have dissolved. He would have retreated and fought another day. But of course, it wouldn't have been a positive thing for his army. But Burnside, I think, could have won had he, yes, not delayed and waited. Yes.
Yeah. It has been said that one of the reasons for the Emancipation Proclamation was to prevent England from supporting the South. Well, really, how serious was that? Or was just the belief that they would more serious than it actually was?
I think Lincoln did it knowing that it would probably help relations with the British government. But I don't think it was the most important factor. I would rate it secondary. Having England being friendly and certainly not recognizing the Confederacy was important, but it wasn't critical. This was to change the balance on the battlefield, I think, and to rally the staunchest of the Union supporters. And thirdly or fourthly is a diplomatic maneuver. Yes, sir.
This isn't in 1862, but reading Killing Lincoln, how in heaven's name did Lincoln's bodyguard, John Parker, ever get away with being such a dereliction of duty, especially at the assassination, and never got any action against him for that? Any thoughts on that?
One thing I think would be that Lincoln himself was not concerned about security issues, and so there wasn't a huge precision about guarding him. I think the focus on finding the Confederates was so intense. Stanton, at the Joseph Holt, the two who were most in control, were totally focused on finding the men who had done it. I think those would be reasons. It does seem kind of shocking. Or why wasn't there better security? Why didn't the theater, which the president attended often, have an extremely secure presidential booth? I mean, why didn't they have a heavy duty to have a secure place for him? But that I don't think that ever came up at all, even.
I think we look at this with the hindsight of knowing all of the events and also experiencing subsequent assassination and assassination attempts. And it's much easier for us all these years later to say, well, why didn't you do that and why didn't you do that? As I look at the Civil War, I wouldn't call it a tactical strategical war. It was blundering into bloodshed. That's all they ever did. They had a plan. The plan usually fell through, and they ended up killing each other.
Too
and they marched
often,
through the whole
right.
country doing that.
Yes. In the end, I think that the numerical and economic superiority of the North mattered more than any battlefield scheming. I would say this. There was one attempt, at least one that I know of, on a president, apparently deranged man took two pistols to try to kill Andrew Jackson, and both misfired. So it had happened that a president's life had been in danger, but everything about the Civil War was new, and Lincoln's lack of concern about his own safety meant there wasn't enough done, for a long the White House was a place people just came and went. And so it would have taken a huge change in thinking. Some of the time, this friend of his, Ward Hill Lamon, just slept in the White House in a hallway with a couple of guns and a knife. And that was the security. And so it was all sort of impromptu and from another time, and the expectations that might happen were very remote, yeah. It was all different, yeah.
If the Union would have won Vicksburg, would that have been a very big turning point in the war?
It was important later when they won, and the sooner they won, I think the more it would have helped the Union cause. But eventually, Robert E. Lee had to be defeated, and so someone had to win in the Eastern Theater and not just defeat Lee's army, but end it as an active force, so that there was no energetic support for a Confederate government. But winning at Vicksburg would have been valuable, and it's one of the great battles of 1863, and one of the hinges, and almost prophetically it happens a day after the victory at Gettysburg. And so together they're the great sort of turning point of the military conflict. I must have been 10 or 11, my parents took us on a vacation in the South, and we went to Vicksburg and got a battlefield tour. And it is high up on a bluff, and the river makes an incredible bend, and you can just imagine what targets any Union boat would be down in the river. And of course, then you couldn't come up to attack, and so the defenses of the city were powerful, and eventually Grant just had to starve them out. It was an incredibly potent defensive position, and as long as the Confederates controlled it, they had some access to supplies from Arkansas and Texas. And also, of course, to break it would break the Confederacy in two. It had a kind of symbolic importance. And then it meant economically, goods could flow up and down the river for the Union. Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed this.
You've been listening to a program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Spencer Davis, professor of history at Peru State College. Dr. Davis has given the final talk in his 4 lecture series on the topic, The American Civil War, a look back 150 years ago. Today's topic was, Where Do We Go From Here? October to December 1862. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Saturday afternoon, December 8, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Shauna Forsberg, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. We're happy to announce that the Durham Museum series of talks on the 150th anniversary of the Civil War will continue later this year with a 3 lecture series on the year 1863. Beginning in April, Mark Shearer, Associate Professor and Chairman of the Department of History at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, and Danielle Battisti, Assistant Professor of History at UNO, will give talks about the Battle of Gettysburg, the New York City draft riots, and the anti-slavery movement in the North. More information about specific times and dates can be found at durhammuseum.org. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.